Well, things are bad, and they're getting worse. The world's getting killed, and it doesn't really, you know, we can look at pretty much whatever biological indicator we want, and it's going in the wrong direction. And if somebody would have measured the fish, weighed the fish in the oceans in 1870, this is after there had been a lot of overfishing already. If somebody would have weighed the fish in the oceans in 1870, and then they weigh them again now, the fish in the oceans weigh about 10% as much as they did back then. This is total weight of all the fish in the oceans. They have reduced the weight of fish in the oceans by 90%. And as we know, there is 6 to 10 times as much plastic as phytoplankton in the ocean. A few years ago, I got really upset because I read that songbird populations in the northeastern United States had collapsed by about 80% in the last 40 years. And I remained upset until I remembered that 40 years ago was after Silent Spring, which means it's even worse, that 80% collapse came on a previous collapse because of pesticides, and that came on a previous collapse because of urbanization and destruction of habitat in the first place. And, you know, they are actually changing the climate, and it doesn't matter where you look, there are solid scientists who are saying the oceans could be devoid of fish within 50 years, within 35 years, actually. And, you know, just where I live, I don't know if you've got sow bugs over there, little roly-polies, but I carry in wood for my mom every evening, firewood. And every day when I carry in the wood, I brush the spiders and sow bugs off the wood so they don't get burned alive. And 10 years ago, I used to brush off 5 sow bugs per piece of firewood. And I think this whole winter, I've probably seen about 30 sow bugs. Just 10 years ago, there used to be these huge flocks of tiny little blue butterflies I would see every spring. And I would see hundreds of them drinking water from mud holes. And I don't see them anymore. I used to see bats quite often here, and I almost never see them anymore. I'm sitting by a pond right now, and I've been sitting here for about a half hour, and at this time of the year, sitting here for a half hour, I should have seen 4 or 5 newts come to the surface of the pond, and I haven't seen any. I'm seeing some dead frog egg sacs in front of me. There are some live frog egg sacs, but the frogs aren't nearly so loud as they were just a few years ago. It doesn't matter what you love, it's under assault. And so, you know, no matter where we look, the world's being killed. And this is just the stuff, you know, last summer, I mean, I still live in a forest, a fairly intact forest. And last summer, there was one day where I was at my mom's house, or one evening, and it was great because there were foxes came up, and then raccoons, and then black bears, and then the raccoons came back, and then the foxes came back, and then the black bears, and it was like a French farce where somebody leaves stage left and somebody exits stage left and somebody comes on stage right. And this is all great until I remembered the next day that before conquest, before this place started getting trashed, you would see a grizzly bear every 15 minutes. And the point is that there's a thing called declining baselines where if you accept something, I mean, if conditions get worse and worse, and you can come to accept that as the new normal, and then you don't miss what's gone, and it's hard to miss what you don't know should be there, and it's hard to love what you don't see at all. And we get really used to declining baselines, and this happens in every part of our life. It happens in abusive relationships, where if you're treated worse and worse, you come to accept that as the normal. It happens with surveillance. You know, in the 1930s in the United States, when they introduced Social Security, there were people complaining, this is a number that will follow you from cradle to grave. And they were really freaking out about this at the time. But now we would be happy if it was only a number that was followed as cradle to grave, as opposed to the government recording every phone call, recording where you go with every, you know, every time you take a drive, your license plate gets recorded and so on. It's all, you know, but we come to accept it. And one of the best lines that I wrote in my 20s was, I lived in this house that the previous person had had a cat that lived in the basement and pooped down in the basement, and the air intakes for the furnace were near the dirt area where the cat would poop in the basement, and so the whole house smelled like cat poop. And I wrote a note to a friend of mine maybe after I'd been there for 6 months renting the place, and I said, you know, at first the stench really got to me, but it's just like everything else. After a while, I got used to it, and I just can't smell it anymore. And that's what happens with so much. And so one of the first things I think we have to do is to pay attention to what's happening, and we have to feel the loss of what's happening. And I know it's really painful, but we have to start feeling that. And then of course, we have to stop it. And so the first thing, how are things going in the world? Things are going very poorly. And we're talking about this culture really systematically dismantling the ecological, every natural community in the world. It's dismantling the ability of the world to stay alive. And we see natural communities unraveling everywhere. And we see things getting worse and worse. We don't see any cessation. We're crying out loud. They are fracking their own water supplies now. You know, it's just crazy. This is the question I've asked for years is, you know, who would be stupid enough to put poison on your own food in terms of insecticides? But it's, you know, it's crazy to put neurotoxins on your own food. But it's even crazier, if that's possible, to put poison in your own water supplies. That's completely insane. And once you destroy an aquifer, it's gone. And it cannot be cleaned up in any realistic time frame. And so we're seeing things. Not only are we not stopping the destruction, we're not even slowing the acceleration of the destruction. It's getting faster and faster. Oh, here's another thing. I'm sitting by the pond. I have yet to see a dragonfly. And I used to see 5-10 years ago, it would not have been unlikely for me to be seeing 50 to 100 dragonflies flying over the pond right now. I've seen one dragonfly so far this year. Anyway, so no matter where you look, things are really bad. And so I think it's really important too. So that's the first thing. The second thing is, where does this destructiveness come from? And part of my analysis is that the destructive is inherent in this culture when you commit yourself to a way of living that is overshoot. And you know, so many indigenous people have said to me that the first and most important thing that we need to do is to decolonize our hearts and minds. And what people have said to me that means is that we need to, for example, see that this way of life is inherently destructive, that it's not just an accidental thing. It's not just, oh, one little mistake, and if we make things more efficient, then things will be better. The problem is even deeper than that. The problem is what we need to do is we need to shift our loyalty from this system to the real physical world. You know, what do so many of the, or basically all of the solutions, so-called solutions to global warming that are presented by the mainstream, what do they all have in common? What they all have in common is they take industrial capitalism as a given, and the natural world is having to conform to industrial capitalism. And that's literally insane in terms of being out of touch with physical reality, because without a real world, you don't have any social system whatsoever. The real world has to be primary. And that's the first thing we need to do, is to switch our loyalty over to the natural world. Once you do that, everything else is really just tactical. But I want to go a slightly different direction here, and I want to point out, you know, they say that one of the signs of intelligence is the ability to recognize pattern. I want to lay out a pattern and see if we can recognize it in less than 6,000 years. And the pattern is this. When you think of Iraq, is the first thing you think of cedar forest so thick that sunlight never touches the ground? Well, that's what Iraq was prior to the beginnings of this culture. And one of the first written myths of this culture is Gilgamesh deforesting the plains and hillsides of Iraq and to make cities. And then the same is true. The Arabian Peninsula was oak savanna. The Near East was heavily forested. Greece was heavily forested. That was all. It was deforested. There were those famous dead Greek philosophers like Socrates and Aristotle and Plato. They were complaining that deforestation was harming water quality. And I have no doubt that the Greek Department of Environmental Quality told them they need to study this problem for a few years and make sure there's really a correlation. North Africa was heavily forested. Those forests went down for the Phoenician and Egyptian navies. There were hippos on the Thames. Actually, those were not killed by the Romans, which I thought at first. They were actually killed by the first agriculturalists. And what happens in agriculture is you kill off, you take a plow to it, and you kill every living being down to the bacteria, and then you convert it all to human use. And when you convert a land to human or, more recently, industrial use, of course you're going to kill off everybody else who lives there. And so my point is, we have a pattern of 6,000 years or longer of this culture destroying land bases. And because it destroys its own land base, it then has to move on to destroy another and another and another. And that's one of the bad news. And another part of the bad news is in destroying your land base, it gives you a competitive advantage over other cultures. And so it's easier to conquer them, because it's much easier to conquer somebody if you cut down your forests and use those to make war machines like the Egyptian or Phoenician Navy, or if you dig up the soil to build war machines like tanks or guns or airplanes, then you have a competitive advantage over the people who don't do that. So this has been a problem that's been going on. And one of the problems that this leads to, as well as destroying the planet, is it requires frontiers. It requires expansion. It requires yet another hill you can deforest. And the planet has put up with as much abuse as it can and is now dying. So one of the things I think is really important to do is for us to see the larger pattern. And one of the problems of seeing a larger pattern is it gets really scary and really overwhelming, because, I mean, the world is being killed, and how can I stop that by myself? And so what I'm going to do now is I'm going to tell you about the smartest decision I ever made. The smartest decision I ever made was when I was about 25 or 26. I realized I wasn't paying enough for gasoline, by which I meant I realized that I was, at the time, gasoline was about 80 cents a gallon, and I don't know what that is in metric and in pounds, but it doesn't really matter. It was much cheaper than it is now. But I realized that no matter how much I was paying, I wasn't paying enough to cover the ecological and social costs. So what I would do is, for every dollar I spent, I would give a dollar to a local environmental organization, never a national, a local one. And the reason, and then they could do something. They're always starved for money. But I didn't have any money myself, so very quickly, instead of that, what I decided to do is I would pay myself $5 an hour to do activism. And this was the greatest thing, because before then, I'd always been paralyzed because the problems are so big and what can I do? And so I didn't do anything. But the real distinction is not between those who wish to act really aggressively or those who wish to bring everything down and those who don't. The big distinction is between those who do something and those who do nothing. And so it got me started doing something. I started by writing letters to the editor, and then I did anti-fur demos, and then I did anti-circus demos, and then I went from there to doing timber sale appeals to stop the illegal sale of timber on the federal lands here. And then I realized within a few months that I could quit keeping track of how many hours I could keep, you know, doing this little accounting system, because I was having so much fun with the activism that I didn't need to keep track. And that's what got me really started on it. And so the first point is, do something and find something you love. And people say, well, what should I do? And the way I always answer that is a few questions. First off, you know, what do you love? Because whatever you love is probably under assault. And so just start defending it. It's like the frogs I mentioned earlier. They're collapsing. And so I looked at why they're collapsing and how they're collapsing here. There are frogs collapsing elsewhere for other reasons, but here I can do this. And what I am doing here is, the reason they're dying here is because the weakening of the ozone layer has made their frog egg sacs weaker, because it allows more UVB to come through, which weakens the egg sac, which harms some species and doesn't harm others. And so when I learned that, when I came out and looked and then did the research, what I started doing is taking in some of the egg sacs into my house. I'd get in the pond, go take the egg sacs in the house, and UVB doesn't go through glass. So I raise them, I let the eggs hatch in the house, and I bring them back out and put them in the pond. And I've been doing this for 7 or 8 years now. Later today, I'm going to get in the pond. I do it about once a week all through the spring. And that's just a tiny thing. There's, of course, many other things you can do. But find what you love and then defend it. And then the next thing people ask is, the next thing I say when people ask, well, what should I do? Is I say, well, I don't know what your gifts are, so I can't tell you what to do. I don't know what you get off on doing day by day. Years ago, trying to stop this, they call them developers, but they're not developers, because a caterpillar develops into a butterfly, and a child develops into an adult, and a meadow does not develop into a white box house. So killers, you know, there's these killers going to come in and kill some of the forest here. So we in the neighborhood were fighting them, and one of the things we did is we hired a wetland specialist to tell us that the lands are wetlands, because that helps to make it easier to protect. And I'm standing there with a guy, and he's digging through the soil and then rubbing the soil between his fingertips to tell what color it is. And then he compares that to a color chart, which tells him it's wetland soil. And I'm watching him do this, and I say, do you get off on doing this? He says, oh, yeah, this is my second favorite thing to do in the world after playing with my dogs. And I said, that's really great, because I actually don't think I would like doing this at all. On the other hand, I completely get off on trying to figure out the relationship between perceived entitlement, exploitation, and atrocity. So I basically have condemned myself to a life of homework, but I completely get off on it, which he would have hated. On the other hand, he's doing what he loves. So find out, you know, it's like people say, God, Derek, you should be an organizer. I can't talk to people. It's like I can't go up and talk to people I don't know, you know? And also when I was doing the timber sale appeals, that was a lot of sort of legal work. And I could do it, you know, I could read through the environmental impact statement, find the lies, but it was really hard for me. And somebody else might walk into the room, somebody else who's really good at it could walk into the room, flip the document open to page 235 and say, we've got them right there on 16 CFR 3914. You know, they knew how to do this really well. And so it would take me 10 hours to do something that it would take them 20 minutes to do, which doesn't mean I shouldn't do it, but it means that they're much better. So find what you're really good at and do it. And then another question is, what are the gifts that are unique to you and all the universe, and how can you use those gifts in the service of your land base? And ask that question. And if you're in your early 20s, part of your job is to find out what your gifts are and find out how that you can use them in the service of your land base. You know, I've worked with attorneys, and that takes a certain mindset. And I've written legal type stuff, and it's really hard for me. On the other hand, I can write my stuff. So it's really good. I'm doing my stuff, and the attorneys are doing their stuff. And we need to all work together, even if we don't agree all the time. You know, we don't have to have 100% ideological agreement to work on things, because the problems are so big that we should work with people where we can, how we can. And here's really what I want to leave people with, is that I've asked this, one of my environmental mentors, one of the people who really got me into environmental work in the first place, I always ask him why he does the work. And what he always says is that we can't predict the future. And he just wants to make sure that as things become increasingly chaotic, he wants to make sure that some doors remain open. And what he means by that is he works to protect grizzly bears, for example. And part of the reason is because if grizzly bears are around in 10 years, they may be around in a million. And if they're gone in 10 years, they're gone forever. And if the frogs in this pond are gone, then they're gone. And if they're here, they may be here in the future. If the bull trout are around in 10 years, they may be around in 100. But if they're gone in 10, they're gone forever. If there's some old growth forest that's being cut, if it's cut, it's pretty much gone forever. If it's there, it may go in the future, or it may not. We can't predict the future. So what we really need to do is to defend whatever we can. And some of us need to defend. Some of us need to work proactively to bring down this whole culture that's killing the planet. But if you don't want to do that, then there is so much work to do to defend other creatures and to help them to survive until, you know, most of the environmentalists I know are hanging on by our fingernails, hoping and praying that this or that creature we love or this or that place we love survives until the whole system comes crashing down. And the transition town people understand this too. And what we need to do is we need to protect the place. I know this guy in northwestern Illinois who loves prairies, and he is helping to protect like the last 6 acres of native prairie in his county. And that's incredibly important work. You know, some people need to do that. And so what I want to leave people with is to, you know, find what it is you can do, find how you can serve the land, and then do it.